Okay, this is lesson number 17, and we will be talking about a couple of interesting gentlemen that came out of Germany. We'll be talking about Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Martin Niemöller, two against the flow, and we'll touch a little bit on Soviet anti-Semitism and Zionism in the modern state of Israel. We'll finish with that. We've talked about Zionism over the last several lessons as because really, there was a lot happening in Jewish history and in anti-Semitism parallel to that from the late 1800. You remember the event that really sparked the whole Zionism, the need for a state for the Jewish people was the Dreyfus Affair in Paris, and Theodor Herzl was actually an Austrian Jewish reporter in 1896, and that's when you realize we got to do something here. So we started to talk about Zionism, which had, of course, started before that as far as coming together the ideas of getting Jewish people back to the land of back then what was called Palestine. So you've had little slices of Zionism through history, all the way up to tonight when we're going to talk briefly about the rebirth of the state of Israel, the modern state of Israel. So that's why Zionism was covered over three different classes in the last few weeks. Okay, so first of all, two against the flow. Now, there were more than two. There were more than two. Really, they're quite unique characters, those two German gentlemen. But there were a lot of people, not just in Germany, there were a lot of people in France were part of the French resistance, meaning to resist, you know, against the enemy, the underground factions of men and women and even some children that would fight, do whatever they could to stop the war or slow it down or hinder the enemy. So there was quite a few people that did things, good things in the war, during the war, in just about every country. And of course, there were also a lot who did nothing or went against the Jewish people and different people in different countries. But here, those two are remembered for a few things that they've done, and they're worth mentioning. So by the time that Hitler was in power, after he became Chancellor of Germany in 1933, the whole country, still in disarray from World War I, was trying to rise from its own ashes. The Jews were held responsible for World War I. By now, you know, if something happens, you know, if it's going to rain tomorrow, the Jews brought the rain. But if it's going to be sunshine, they brought the drought. That's the bottom line, okay? That's the history of the Jews for the last 2,000 years. So the Jews were held responsible for World War I, the defeat and the economic collapse of Germany. Thus, they had to be stopped. We had to stop the Jews because, you know, they're responsible for every angle, every aspect. Hitler's agenda would have not succeeded if he had not been joined by an endless list of this is not my word. This was, I believe, coined by author Deborah Lipstadt, who wrote several books on against Holocaust denial and actually won a lawsuit in England against a gentleman who said the Holocaust never happened and made the news a few years ago. And I think she's the one who coined that word, willing executioners. Because a lot of German Nazis would back in, you know, at the time of the Nuremberg trials in 1945, they said, hey, I was just following orders. I had no choice. Had I not followed orders, I would have been killed myself. There's some truth to that. But when you see the two gentlemen that we're about to talk about tonight, you also find out that there were people that were willing to lose their life to save people, namely the Jewish people. And actually, some did lose their life. So the willing executioners were people that actually were basically in favor of helping Hitler do, you know, fulfill his agenda of the destruction of European Jewry. So he would have not, Hitler would have not succeeded if he had not been joined by an endless list of willing executioners within Germany and other countries as well. Along with those who did nothing, perpetrators such as the Nazis or the French Vichy government. Vichy is a town in the center of France, and that's where the government, led by Marshal Pétain, was. It was a government that was actually, during the war, that was working with the Nazis to make things a little better for the French. And in the process, of course, some of the Vichy government leadership and followers were worse than some of the people in the Gestapo. So perpetrators such as the Nazis or the French Vichy government were joined by a plethora of bystanders. Ethically, the bystanders are as guilty as the perpetrators, not just ethically, but legally as well. The reason for many to do so little were very different, be it fear of reprisals for some, personal gain for others, or of course simply Judeophobia for the majority. The results were astronomical. 6 million Jews. But the reasons were, you know, all kinds of different reasons. I mean, the gentleman who gave away my grandfather, to this day we don't know why he did it. He survived the war. He held me on his lap. I don't remember that, but my mother told me, and it makes me kind of feel very funny. But we don't know if he just hated the Jews. I don't think he did really hate the Jews like 100%. Maybe he was offered a little booklet of food stamps, and his family didn't have any food. Or maybe there was other reasons. He worked for the French police, which had a lot of connection with the Vichy government. And so we don't know. He's just one example of many. And, you know, so the reason why the perpetrators and the bystanders did what they did are many, and there are many more than what I listed, and sometimes it's a combination of several. Lynn? Oh, okay. So, now the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church were both guilty of perpetrating and bystanding. They did both. They were perpetrating and bystanding. The controversial Pope of the time, as if they're not all somewhat controversial, Pope Pius the 12th did very little to help the Jews on ground of neutrality. He didn't want to get involved. That's the epitome of bystanding, if you ask me, which is of course as guilty as perpetrating. A ground of neutrality under the Vatican banner. Now, even if he himself was responsible, now we have records that he did help a small number of Jewish people, and he encouraged others to do so. But I'm telling you, when you think about it, in his position, he could have done a lot more. A lot more. Not just a few more Jews. He could have put an end. He could have done a lot more. But, you know, the church, there's a great book, by the way. I should have put that in there. I might have, but I don't think I did. A book by a pastor of Moody Church by the name of Erwin Lutzer. You might have heard his name. And it's called Hitler's Cross. And it's a great research on the converging of Nazism and the Christian German church during the Second World War, and how the Christian German church basically decided that they were going to merge with Nazism and just go with the Nazi agenda under the Christian banner. That doesn't help people like us talk to Jewish people and say, hey, or like somebody like me who's Jewish who say, I'm a believer in Jesus, and they say, well, you're a Christian. So, well, whatever you want to call me. But, you know, but the problem is when if I call myself a Christian, which I have no problem doing, but with my Jewish people, if I call myself a Christian and they know all those things, they go like, well, yeah, the German Christian church worked with Hitler to annihilate 6 million Jews. So, you know, that's not necessarily a true statement 100%, but the reality is the German church kind of gave up on trying to do anything. The Vatican didn't help, just on grounds of neutrality. So they're responsible for quite a bit. So the Pope Pius the 12th, many books have been written about him in favor of what he did for the Jews, and books discrediting him and saying he didn't do much, and books saying he did nothing. So you got to be careful. He did a little bit, but he could have done a lot more. Yet in the midst of so much hatred and how do you say this word that I wrote? I know it's cowardice. This is because, you know, English is my second language, so I French speak. So anyway, that's my excuse once in a while. I know the word, I just don't know how to say it. Cowardice. Okay, and so in the midst of so much hatred and cowardice, a few heroes stand up in a crowd characterized by indifference. That's the big thing. And that's, you know, it's, think about it, indifference is a, as much violence and hatred as we've seen over the last 2,000 years, a lot of indifference goes through that entire history that we went through for the, you know, 2,000 years. And today, it's the same. A lot of what happens, not just against the Jewish people, but all the injustice, all the ethnic cleansing, all when you kill a lot of people, I can't find my words tonight. Genocide, thank you. All the genocides and the ethnic cleansing in all over the world. Most people don't care. It's too far. It's not in my backyard. It's far enough that if I see it on the news, I can turn it off, or, you know, just watch a rerun of something. It's just somewhere in Africa, somewhere in Asia, somewhere in South America. Ah, it's not here. You know, can I still get what I want to get here? My coffee, my food, my movies? Sure, I don't care. So a lot of indifference. And that is something that we have to be very careful about, because indifference will... great quote by comes to mind by... I have a feeling tonight I'm going to be missing a lot of words for some reason. The historian who wrote a biography of Adolf Hitler, his name is not Roald Hilberg, his name is Abraham Herschel. And he said the road to Auschwitz was built by hate, but paved with indifference. The road to Auschwitz was built by hate, but paved with indifference. That is a really good quote right there. Okay, so paved, yeah, by indifference. And I think I already quoted this in the class prior, and it must be, it's going to be somewhere in your notes. I did, yeah, okay. Yes. Correct, including the U.S. Including the U.S., that is correct. Many countries heard about it, knew about it. The United States had a chance to bomb Auschwitz, but they were more concerned about killing civilians, which ended up almost all of them dying anyway. It's a kind of a dark side of the Allies and the United States and other countries. It's just a weird part of the war, Marion. He? Oh, yeah. Right. But that didn't work out quite well. And the Brits did a bad face after the Balfour Declaration. We'll talk a little bit about it tonight. So let me get back into the text here. The first gentleman that I want to talk about a little bit is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. 1906-1945. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a German Lutheran pastor who participated in the German resistance against Hitler and the Nazi agenda. He got as far as being involved in a plan to assassinate Hitler. And the plan was foiled and resulted in his arrest in 1943. And he's dead in 1945, so he doesn't have much left after that. But he was really, really trying to stop Hitler. A lot of books, people have talked about him, thinking, you know, how Christian was what he did? How Christian was that to try to kill somebody to stop him from pursuing his agenda? There's a lot of ethics involved in that, and people agree and disagree, and I think that it would have been the right thing, but then again, you know, I'm biased because I'm Jewish, so, but I don't think it was necessarily unchristian to do this. He didn't succeed. He was also one of the founding members of the Confessing Church. The Confessing Church was a small, very small section of the German Protestant Church during the war. It was a body of German evangelicals who fought to preserve Orthodox Christianity from being infiltrated and corrupted by Nazis. Basically, if you read the book by Erwin Lutzer, Hitler's Cross, you'll be reading about these people, the two guys I'm talking to you about, and about the Confessing Church. At first, he was the only voice against Hitler within the church, but he was later joined by others. The Confessing Church, while not a major movement, was still a significant source of opposition to Hitler and his agenda of destruction. Additionally, Bonhoeffer believed that God had a special plan for the Jewish people. So he had his theology right, okay? And now, Bonhoeffer, this is crazy. Bonhoeffer was so secure in his position in Messiah that he was willing to die for the truth and for his faith. He was interrogated, imprisoned in Berlin, and eventually moved to the concentration camp at Flossenbürg, where he was executed on April 9, 1945. That's a mistake. Yeah, change that. 1945. Switch those two numbers right here. 1945, 23 days before the end of World War II. You wonder sometimes, why would God not allow him to live another 3 weeks and just make it? That was not God's plan. At Flossenbürg, the camp doctor who witnessed Bonhoeffer's hanging said this: "I saw Pastor Bonhoeffer kneeling on the floor, praying fervently to God. I was most deeply moved by the way this lovable man prayed, so devout and so certain that God heard his prayer. At the place of execution, he again said a short prayer and then climbed the few steps to the gallows, brave and composed. His death ensued after a few seconds. In the almost 50 years that I worked as a doctor, I have hardly ever seen a man die so entirely submissive to the will of God." Seconds before he died, he was in communion with God, and he was praying to God. But most importantly, he was willing to lose his life in fighting against Hitler and his agenda. And he did lose his life. The next gentleman is, and they are contemporaries of one another, of each other, is Martin Niemöller. Martin Niemöller lived a little longer. He lived almost to be 100, actually, 96, I think, or 92. Martin Niemöller was another Lutheran pastor and anti-Nazi theologian, even though a Hitler supporter at first. He didn't see, he didn't immediately go against Hitler. He didn't do that until he saw the injustice and the racial laws, then he changed his mind. He was one of the original founder of the Confessing Church with Dietrich Bonhoeffer. There's a picture of him right there on the page. Martin Niemöller reacted to Hitler's agenda by preaching against it in many of his sermons that he typed and copied for mass distribution through Germany. I think his typewriter that he used is at the Holocaust Museum Memorial in Washington, D.C. In 1933, he created the Pastors Emergency League, a group of evangelical pastors committed to help non-Aryans clergy and fight the newly formed German Christian Church. Again, that's documented in the book by Erwin Lutzer. And by the way, Erwin Lutzer's book is the name and the information on page 2 in the footnotes. The PEL, Pastors Emergency League, was the forerunner of the Confessing Church, created in 1934. He met, Martin Niemöller, met with Hitler and a few other pastors in 1934. Actually met him in person. He was the only of all the pastors present in that room that day not to sign an unconditional loyalty agreement with Hitler. He was arrested on multiple occasions after that, from 1934 to 1937. In 1938, he was convicted under the law, and this is a mouthful right here. Okay, ready? Convicted under the law for the prevention of treacherous attacks on state and party, and the law for the maintenance of respect for party. What is it all about? I don't know. But it's a long name. Basically, they found a way to arrest him and convict him for what he was doing against the party. He spent the following 7 years in concentration camps as well, before being liberated in 1945. Today he is perhaps best remembered for this poem, a powerful reminder that each one of us can and should do something against injustice and xenophobia. You might have heard this before, but it was worth rewriting in there. There's a little poem or a little saying that he is credited with. First they came for the socialist and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionist and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me and there was no one left to speak for me. Okay? Now this is something that you can easily transfer onto today and look at what's happening in our world with the rise of Islam and radical Islam and all the multiple attempts at implementing Sharia law. We look at this and we go like, well, you know, it's for the Muslims, it's not really concerning us. Eventually, there'll be a time where if we don't do anything because it's not concerning us, it's going to be established in such a way that if we don't become Muslims, we'll be very concerned because we won't have law, we won't have any rights, especially women. So I pray regularly that we will never get to that place, but it's getting there at a very rapid pace in Europe. Europe is on the road to perdition. There's no coming back. Europe will become a Muslim continent within the next 20 or 30 years. No way around it. You can't come out of it just because of the way demographics are working over there. And if we don't do anything here, and to be honest with you, I don't see a lot of people doing a whole lot here. We're going the same direction. So remember that little poem, okay? Now here's another little aspect of Martin Niemöller. As much as Niemöller was convinced that Hitler was wrong, and as much as he did to fight against the Nazification of the German Protestant Church, he was mostly interested in the fate of Christians or of the Jewish people that had adopted the Christian faith, people like myself. He did not really concern himself with the Jewish people as a whole. Was more concerned about clergy and Christians and Jews who had become believers. It's actually not until 1963 that in a German television interview, he made a statement where he said that he regretted his own anti-Semitism. So even he was, you know, it seems that, you know, you find it everywhere. But this put aside, these two men actually were bold enough within the church to speak up. And I'm sure they're not the only two. I read about others, but, you know, I couldn't put them all on the list. But those are the two names that you read about, that you even read in college. You read about Martin Niemöller and Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So people know about them. So I thought I would at least mention them to you. Okay, questions about that? Okay, point number two, Soviet anti-Semitism. Now, after the war was over, it didn't take long for anti-Semitism to show its ugly head again. Only 5 years after Hitler's death in 1945, Soviet anti-Semitism was in full force. That really never really disappeared. It's like, the couple of decades after the war. We'll talk more about that probably next week. But from the late 40s until the late 60s or 70s, nobody wanted to talk about anti-Semitism. Nobody wanted to talk about the Holocaust. It was like, you know what, taboo. Okay, let's just kind of move on from this. Let's hope that the world has learned its lesson. And of course, you already know the answer. We're in 2011. The world has not learned its lesson, and we are right now with a full rise of anti-Semitism right now. So only 5 years after Hitler's death in 1945, Soviet anti-Semitism was in full force. After the 1917 revolution, Russian Jewish status was a little confusing, if not contradictory. Many Jewish people had been won by the concept of communism, and in the process had been de-Judaized to fit the new ideology of a classless society, you know, under the Russian communist ideology. The government started to outlaw synagogues and Hebrew learning, and within 15 years, The numbers of Jewish congregation, we're talking about 15 years after the 1917 revolution. We're going back a little bit in history in Russia here in the Soviet Union. Within 15 years, the number of Jewish congregations had been reduced to just a few, and most Jewish Orthodox practice was not underground, hidden. You had to be very careful. To be sure, the reducing down of the Jewish community to a classless community also happened to other minority groups. It was not just the Jewish people, but maybe a little more focused on the Jewish people, as always, for some reason, when there are, seems to be through history, when there are attacks or attempts at making an ethnic group conform to certain policies or ideologies, the Jews always end up on top of that list somehow. Anti-Semitism did not return on the scene until the 20s, when communist masses started again to build resentment against the Jews. Eventually, by the mid-30s, Soviet anti-Semitism got to its lowest level as there was a semblance of democracy, and many from the West seemed attracted to the East. That's the D missing right there. End. Many from the West. What happened is that in the 20s there was a surge of anti-Semitism. When you have a scapegoat, as I've been calling the Jewish people throughout this whole class, the scapegoats of humanity. When you have a people group like the Jews that has been picked on for 2,000 years, it's just a matter of finding a reason to pick on them. It doesn't matter if it makes any sense at all. The communists picked on the Jews after a while because they would see that some Jewish people who would be successful in business and banking, they would see them as being capitalists, which is the opposite of communism. So that's just not good. We got to get rid of the Jews. So, I mean, no matter which way you look at it, there's always something you can find to just, you know, pin it on the Jews and say, okay, it's your fault. So it was kind of happening that way in the Soviet Union. But it stopped for a while, and there was a little bit of respite for about 10 years or so until Stalin came into the picture. A new reign of terror was about to start with Stalin's dictatorship and his ruthless endeavor to eliminate the old guard of the revolution. Jewish leaders became denounced as traitors almost overnight and were then liquidated, while other less important Jewish figures still involved in the public sector were removed as well. The Jews were carefully being squeezed out from Russian life, basically. The original Soviet-Nazi agreement. Now we're looking at this happens, towards the end of the war here. We're still in the 40s here. The original Soviet-Nazi agreement did nothing to help the Russian Jewish community. Anti-Semitism was being ignored and unreported in Russia, and as a result, Jews remained mostly unaware of the fate awaiting them. Very little was done by Soviets during the war years, to prevent anti-Semitism or help Jewish people. The last 5 years of the Stalin reign or era, 48 through 53, Soviet Jewry went through its worst years, its black years. It did not take long for Jewish people to realize that the anti-Zionist sentiment emanating from Soviet leadership was nothing but anti-Semitism in a new cloak. That was kind of like a new concept. Well, a new concept because, of course, until 1948, there was no Israel to complain about. There was an Israel, but not in the eyes of the world, not a modern state of Israel. Of course, there wasn't Israel because Israel has always existed since God gave the deed to Abraham and said, this is, you know, the land that you see is going to be your land for the Jewish people. But in a modern sense, Israel did not exist until it was reborn as a modern state in 1948. But when that started, something along started at the same time. It was the anti-Zionist movement, so to speak. Zionism continues to develop, continues to grow, and we're going to talk about Zionism in a little bit here. And the anti-Zionist and the anti-Zionist movement comes along and say, "Aha, we're not really against the Jews. It's right on, you know, right the aftermath of the Holocaust." So it's not really kosher, no pun intended, to say enough for the Jews. Maybe Russians, maybe some groups are still dealing with some anti-Semitic, you know, like some hatred, and they're pretty intense about it. But for most of the civilized world, people, including a lot of Germans, it was like, okay, you know what, you guys, let's just either not discuss it or just ignore it, or it's taboo. We don't want to talk about it. So right after 1945, for a couple of decades, the topic of anti-Semitism and the Holocaust was really not discussed that much. There was a sense of collective guilt. We'll talk about that next week as well, especially German collective guilt. And that's why, unfortunately, when you don't talk about something, when you ignore an issue, people have a tendency to think that it either doesn't exist or it's going to go away. If it exists, it will go away if I ignore it. Or if you ignore it for long enough, you don't talk about it, people go like, oh, there's no anti-Semitism. But we'll see that it of course, was not the case. But for a while, people were not, it was just like, we don't talk about that topic. So in the meantime, Soviet Union is closing its borders. And basically the whole world is... the closing of the USSR's border made it very difficult, if not impossible, for Soviet Jews to immigrate until the late 70s, early 80s. While now we're talking about the 1970s, 1980s, okay? We're talking about 30 to 40 years ago. We're like in pretty much in our lifetime now. You know, we've gone through history. Now we're talking about our lifetime. So it's getting a little more personal, I guess. So the Soviet Jews could not really immigrate freely until the late 70s or early 80s, while the rest of European Jews were making aliyah to Eretz Israel. Now, the Jewish people who survived the Holocaust, many of them felt that the best way to fight back the Nazis and the Holocaust was to go to Israel, get settled there, and have babies. And so there was, at that time, a lot of Jewish people were born in the post-war decade of, you know, 45 through 55. You have a lot of Jewish people born because they were like going like, we're going to show them. We survived, and we are going to come out of the ashes. And, of course, God's hand is behind it all. If you study, which we will not have time to do it because it's really not... The scope of this class, if you study the wars from 1948, the 50s, 67, 73, 82, all the wars in Israel, you find out that if you don't believe in God, just watch the Jewish people in the different wars since 1948. Without God, there's no way they should have survived. No way. So Zionism, part three, Zionism and the modern state of Israel. Well, Zionist pioneers continued to settle in Palestine. You know, as much as I don't like the word Palestine, that's what it was called back then, so I try to be, you know, accurate in my description, but I don't like it. Sorry? Well, yeah, the Romans called Israel after the second revolt. I think they called it in the, was it 167? I'm trying to remember when the last revolt of the Jews against the Romans. They called it Palestina to humiliate the Jewish people, and they renamed Jerusalem, Aila Capitolina, something like that in Roman, which had nothing to do with Jerusalem, just to erase any sense of Jewish meaning to the place. Okay, so let's go here. Zionist pioneers continued to settle in Palestine. Zionist pioneers continued to settle in Palestine. The world had just gone through another global conflict where once again the Jewish people had become the scapegoats of humanity, this time in proportions that had never been reached before. Additionally, the large influx of Jewish people in Palestine led to the Arab Revolt of 1936-1939. They were not there was a like a not really a war but a revolt. Very concerned, Britain responded to the revolt by appointing a royal commission. Everything they do in England is royal. You know, it's got to go, you know, through the Queen. That was a joke. Okay, so very concerned, they appointed the royal commission known as the Peel Commission, which recommended that Palestine be partitioned into Arab and Jewish lands. Okay? Concept of a, you know, two-state solution is coming into the picture here. Of course, Balfour in 1920, Lord Balfour had written this famous Balfour Declaration saying that the Jewish people were entitled a land of their own. The Peel Commission led to the publishing of the 1939 White Paper by Britain that would change the promises made by Lord Balfour and seriously limit Jewish immigration into Palestine. It's very important because as a result, there was a time where Jewish people were being led in droves to the gas chambers. And that is the time where you could have said, okay, open the gates. Come into Palestine. Here is, Israel been reborn as a Jewish state in 1939, numbers would be different. Now, why is it? That is not for me to answer. That's for him to answer. And I don't think that's a question I will ever ask him. But I wonder in my flesh, and you know, in this part of my life, as I'm still in my, you know, in my fallen state, you know, forgiven but fallen state, I do not understand why Israel could not be reborn 5 years prior to, you know, or 10 years prior to when it was reborn. But somehow the British had, Lord Balfour had, you know, written the Balfour Declaration, the letter to Lord Rothschild, saying, okay, the Jews have, you know, I agree, they have a place, you know, they should go back to the land, and they also promised the land to the Arabs. So it's like basically double booking, you know. You come to get your, and it's a very poor analogy, but you come to get your plane and you go on a plane and then you have a very important meeting and you find out that they double booked and they'll pay for everything, but they have to put you on another plane. Double booking. Well, the British double promised Palestine to the Arabs and to the Jews. So that didn't help. After Balfour, made his promises. So that was really, really, that did a very nasty, nasty trick to the Jewish people. The war against the Jews, that's the book I've mentioned to you several times, I recommend it as well, as author Lucy Dewitowitz called World War II, eventually ended in 1945 with the capitulation of Germany. 3 years later, another milestone of prophetic proportion was about to happen. Israel was about to be reborn as a modern nation in 1948. Was it the result of the Holocaust or the persistent toiling of the early Zionist fathers? Or both? It's impossible to determine clearly, but it had to happen for future unfulfilled Bible prophecies to eventually take place. We know that. The fact remains that much of the groundwork laid out by visionaries such as Herzl, Weizmann, Aham, and Ben Yehuda was about to pay off, yet not without a further sacrifice that is still being felt today in the 21st century. Again, was the rebirth of the State of Israel a result of the Holocaust? Is it fair? Let's ask ourselves the question. Can we say... we needed the Holocaust to have the State of Israel. Israel would have not been reborn unless the Holocaust would have taken place. Do we know that? No, we don't. I'm always nervous. I'm always nervous to attach, when you attach a curse and a blessing like this, because the rebirth of the State of Israel is a great blessing to the Jewish people. It's also a fulfillment of prophecy. It has to happen for future prophecies coming in our lifetime probably to happen. But to say that this all happened because of the Holocaust, a great influx of Jewish people came out of the Holocaust and went to Israel. They're related. But I cannot say, and we've talked about that a couple of weeks ago, I cannot say, I don't think I'm comfortable saying that the rebirth of the state of Israel, the modern state of Israel, is uniquely because of the Holocaust. That's just, I'm not comfortable with that. But they're related. They're related. In 1947, the United Nations decided to partition Palestine following that historic decision. The leader of the World Zionist Congress at the time was, of course, the leader of the first one was, his name escapes me right now, Herzl, Theodor Herzl. The leader of the one at the time was David Ben-Gurion, declared that Israel was now a state independent of the British mandate for Palestine. Israel was accepted as a full member of the UN in 1949. May 15, 1948, the very next day, the parenthesis in 49 is actually, I mean, it's the dates go 47, 49, 48. The parenthesis is just to tell you that Israel was accepted as a full member in 49. But May 15, 1948, the very next day after the Declaration of Independence, which took place May 14, neighboring Arab nations attacked Israel. And for the last 63 years, Israel has been constantly under attack and or at war. 1948, 56, 67, 73, 82, 87 to 93, 2000, and on and on and on. And when Israel is not officially at war with its Arab neighbors, it's not really at peace. We know that. It's, you know, it's not necessarily every day in the news because people, unfortunately, are getting tired of hearing about, you know, what's going on in the Middle East and Israel all the time. But the reality is there's not one day going in Israel without, you know, fighting, shooting, bombing, terrorist attack or something happening against the Jewish people, against the Jewish land, the Jewish nation. So the boundaries of the land of Israel have been in the media ever since, being described as either disputed or occupied territories. And if I'm going to use one of the two, I would rather use disputed. But they're disputed because people don't agree that it belongs to one party and not the other. And they're definitely not occupied, in a sense of occupation by a foreign people group into a different land. But that's not for now. We don't need to discuss that. Here's a picture of Ben-Gurion declaring the independence of Israel in May 1948. Behind him in the frame is Theodor Herzl, and on each side are two flags of Israel that were actually, the flag of Israel was created, modeled after the prayer shawl, the Talit, with the blue stripes on it, the white prayer shawl with the blue stripes. That's how the flag of Israel was created, I believe. Today, Zionism has become a cuss word. Okay, it's more than a four-letter word, but it's a cuss word. The national movement for the return of the Jewish people to their homeland has now become synonymous with racism. As a matter of fact, we've talked about that recently, but it's worth repeating. The United Nations passed Resolution 3379 in 1975, declaring that Zionism is a form of racism. And it would take 16 years for the UN to revoke that resolution in 1991. It took him 16 years to say, well, maybe those are strong words. Mind you, in the meantime, they continue to organize things like Durban. As I put there, nevertheless, the stigma is still present, and Israel is too often painted as a new Nazis of the Middle East. A conference on racism, or against racism, we should say, named the Durban Conference on Racism, took place in Durban, South Africa, Durban 1, 2001, Durban 2 in Geneva, 2009, where in 2009, where President Ahmadinejad announced that Zionism is racism, back to the same accusation, and of course in New York recently, Durban 3 in 2011. Zionism is here to stay, okay? It's not going away. Many followers of Yeshua look at the Bible and clearly see that God is not done with Israel. I don't know who said it, but I like to say it as much as I can. God is a Zionist. God was the first Zionist, okay? It's not me. I think I might have stolen this from Dr. Michael Rydelnik from Moody when I was at Moody. I don't know. I steal stuff from people all the time, and then I don't remember. So when I quote it, I have to say, it's not me, so forgive me for not remembering who I got it from, but it's not mine. But God was the first Zionist. Followers of Yeshua see a glorious future for the people and for the land of Israel. They understand that the promise of Genesis 12:3 still stands, and that they want to be in the center of God's will by blessing the people that He calls the apple of my eye. God calls the Jewish people the apple of my eye. Now this, again, whenever I quote this verse, or the fact that God really chose the Jewish people and loves the Jewish people, I always have to add this. Jewish people being, quote, unquote, chosen, or being the apple of God's eye, of being a special people, does not give them a free ticket to heaven. How do Jewish people get to heaven? Just the same way everybody gets to heaven, by putting your trust in the death and resurrection of Jesus the Messiah for your sins. It doesn't matter if you're Jewish, Gentile, blue, green, black, even French. I always have to throw in the French in there. So, the French, yeah. Will there be, the question from the British student here, will there be French people in heaven? Is that the question? Exactly. Thank you. Thank you. Moving right along. Okay. So, I think manna was French bread. It was that good. Okay, so now we're way off now. Okay, where was I? Okay, so these people, which people? Okay, these people are often called Christian Zionists, as they recognize Israel's right to the land and the Jewish people's right to return to the land. Christian Zionism is a noble cause and is part of what every Bible-believing Christian should promote, because God Himself declared it to be true in His Word. Okay? Now, again, Christian Zionism, you don't want to go overboard, okay? Anybody, anytime, anywhere can always go overboard and overdo things. Christian Zionism simply means that we recognize the right of Israel to exist. We recognize the right of Jewish people to move to Israel as their land. And there's a biblical principle here. We want the Jews to be blessed. We want them to be blessed, because if we bless the Jews, we'll be blessed. If you curse the Jews, you'll be cursed. So Christian Zionism is that, but you don't want to go overboard into, you know, agreeing and promoting every aspect of everything that happens in Israel. There's a lot of things that, there's parts of the Israeli government that some people in the Israeli government that are corrupted. There is some corruption there too. Every government has corruption, okay? So, biblically speaking, there is a right to the land. There is a right to exist for the Jewish people. They are not occupying the land. They are not terrorists. They are not Nazis in the Middle East. Those are all lies that are built on 2,000 years of misconception that we've almost finished with this class. You see how it all built up and built on top of one another. But so, Christian Zionism is a good thing. You just don't want to paint with a broad stroke and just not, you know, just go like everything Jewish, everything Israel, I love it all. You got to be careful. You got to be balanced. You know, that's what I'm saying here. It is a fact that there are a lot of scriptural evidence validating the claims of Zionism, not to mention that God Himself said that only He own the land in Leviticus 25:23. The land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine. That's God speaking there. For the land is mine. For you are but aliens and sojourners with me. And I put it in bold there. The land is mine. So God says, I give it to you, Abraham, for you and your people to dwell in the land forever. But at the end of the age, the land is mine. Okay, it is God's land. Additionally to recognizing that Jewish people have the right to a land of their own, we must also recognize that Jewish people have a claim to the Jewish Messiah, Yeshua of Nazareth. It is then incumbent on every Christian to share the message of hope of the Jewish Messiah with the original messengers. The foundation for Zionism was established by God in the book of Genesis. It continues to run through like an uninterrupted thread through the tapestry of Jewish history. If Zionism has existed for a long time, we also cannot deny that God used people like Herzl, Aham, Ben Yehuda, Weizmann, Ben Gurion, Golda Meir, and many others to further promote the Jewish people right to the land of Israel. What God established, no man can destroy. Jeremiah 31, 35 through 37. That's when it talks about, God is telling, through the prophet, he's telling basically, if you can destroy the moon and the stars and the sun and the earth, once you're done doing all that, I will forsake Israel for what they've done to me. That's God's tongue-in-cheek way of saying, no way, Jose. That's, in my version, it says, no way, Jose, but that's the Olivier version. Okay. So, I like the quote by Abba Eban. Abba Eban is he was in the Israeli government in the 50s and 60s, I believe, maybe even in the 70s, and he wrote several books, one on the history of the Jewish people. I think it's called A History of My People, I have it at home, I forgot the title. And he's quoted saying, Zionism is nothing more, but also nothing less than the Jewish people's sense of origin and destination in the land linked eternally with its name. That's a good quote right there. I've given you other scripture reference on the bottom of the page for further study on Israel's right to the land. I know all of us here agree with Israel's right to the land, but it's good to have reference to take people to if they argue with you. I will take questions right now. I'm going to...